welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. In Portland, Oregon, a prolonged protest encampment outside the Icefield office in the South Waterfront neighborhood has entered its fifth month, marking one of the most persistent standoffs over immigration policy and federal presence in recent U.S. politics. The modern wave of protests began June 4, 2025, in part as a local echo of nationwide unrest over ICE raids and immigration enforcement practices. From the start, demonstrators gravitated to the ICE facility, both as a symbolic site and as a front line. Over time, the protest has persisted night after night, with some claiming more than 100 consecutive days of activity, though the size, intensity, and character of the protests have ebbed and flowed. It's worth noting that Portland is no stranger to ICE protests. In 2018, the Occupy ICE movement saw activists camp outside the same facility for weeks to challenge the Trump administration's family separation policies. That earlier occupation was eventually cleared by federal law enforcement, but it laid groundwork for the tactics and symbolic orientation now in play. In the early months, many demonstrations were relatively peaceful, chanting, presence, symbolic resistance, but over time clashes have become more frequent. Protesters have erected barricades, using pallets, dumpsters, scooters, to block access to the building and its driveways. On some nights, federal agents have deployed tear gas, flashbang grenades, and pepper projectiles from elevated rooftop positions to push back crowds. At times, objects, rocks, lasers have been thrown. Federal and court filings allege some protesters have shined high-powered lasers at agents, kicked canisters, and assaulted federal officers. Some federal charges have been brought, dozens so far, though local police involvement has remained limited. Local residents near the facility report continuous disturbances, fireworks, noise, explosions, and exposure to chemical munitions residue. Some express frustration about safety, air quality, and lack of rest. In late September 2025, President Trump signed an executive order labeling Antifa a domestic terrorist organization and announced that federal troops would be deployed to Portland and other cities to protect ICE facilities under siege. Oregon officials pushed back. Shortly after, U.S. District Judge Karen Immergut granted a temporary restraining order blocking the deployment of National Guard troops to Portland, ruling that the protests had not been notably violent before the order, and that the federal action might exceed constitutional authority. Portland's mayor and city officials have also publicly opposed military deployment, insisting the city has not requested it, and warning of unconstitutional federal overreach. Meanwhile, federal agencies, including ICE and Homeland Security, claim repeated nightly attacks on the facility, window damage, harassment, barricading, and interference with movement. What's unfolding is not simply a local protest, it's a standoff between federal power, state authority, and protester resistance. The federal narrative frames this as law enforcement defending its property and personnel under threat. The protesters and city officials see it as federal overreach and suppression of dissent. Because this protest has persisted so long, and because the federal government is trying to escalate to troop deployment, the Portland ICE standoff is becoming a test case for what limits remain on deploying military or quasi-military force in U.S. cities. If the administration prevails or stretches authority, this could become a precedent for future interventions. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we take a look at the history behind the organization that has become synonymous with the erupting violence in Portland, Antifa. This story begins in Europe, where antifascistische action first appeared in 1932 Berlin. Then we track how militant anti-fascism and the Black Bloc tactic emerge in post-war and late Cold War movements, explode into view at global summits, and finally cross into U.S. protest culture, from Seattle's WTO meetings to Occupy Wall Street and the Trump era. Along the way, we'll ask, what is Antifa? A group, a tactic, or an idea? The recognizable two red flags logo, the militant posture, the very word Antifa, these originate with Antifaschistische Action, unveiled by Germany's Communist Party, KPD, in May 1932. The group was launched during the final chaotic months of the Weimar Republic. At that time, the KPD was the largest communist party outside the Soviet Union, and it was deeply tied to Moscow through the Communist International, or Comintern, an organization created by Lenin in 1919 to guide global communist movements. Under Stalin, the Comintern was still active, but by 1928, it had adopted the Third Period Doctrine, which declared that capitalism was entering its terminal crisis and that communist parties should reject alliances with social democrats, who were branded social fascists. That policy effectively isolated the KPD from the more moderate SPD, social democrats, and deepened divisions on the left, divisions that Hitler later exploited. Thus, Antifaschistische Action's ideological framework and messaging were strongly influenced by Stalinist Comintern directives. Because of their opposition to the moderate social democrats, the Weimar left was fractured. The Social Democratic Party, SPD, backed the Iron Front, an anti-fascist, pro-democracy street organization identified by the three arrows, and explicitly opposed both the Nazis and the KPD. The KPD, aligned with the Comintern's Third Period, often labeled social democrats social fascists, treating the SPD as a main adversary even as the Nazi threat rose. That intra-left conflict, Iron Front versus Antifaschistische Action, is a crucial context that gets lost in today's shorthand. After Hitler's appointment as Chancellor in January 1933, the KPD and Antifaschistische Action were banned. Many leaders fled or were imprisoned. Some refugees did make it to the USSR and later joined the anti-fascist resistance during the Spanish Civil War or World War II. However, the term anti-fascism survived, adapted, reinterpreted, and later revived by post-war left movements across Europe. Modern Antifa imagery, masking up, moving as a cohesive swarm, quick strikes against property, owes a lot to the autonomous scene in West Germany during the 1980s. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, West Germany witnessed the emergence of a loosely organized radical left movement known as the Autonomen, literally, the autonomous ones. The name reflected their defining principle, autonomy from political parties, unions, and even structured organizations within the broader left. The Autonomen were not a single group, but a constellation of collectives, squats, and affinity groups united by militant opposition to capitalism, patriarchy, imperialism, and state authority. The Autonomen grew out of the debris of the New Left and student movements of the late 1960s, which had splintered after the failure of parliamentary socialism and the disillusionment with state communism. By the late 1970s, urban youth, many from universities, art circles, and working-class neighborhoods, were facing rising rents, youth unemployment, and the threat of gentrification. Squatting empty buildings became both a political act and a necessity, particularly in cities such as Berlin, Hamburg, and Frankfurt. These squats evolved into semi-permanent autonomous zones, self-governing spaces with their own social centers, communal kitchens, and radical bookstores. Ideologically, the Autonomen drew inspiration from Italian autonomia, a workers' movement emphasizing self-organization outside party structures, feminism, and anarchist theory. Their political expression, however, was distinctly street-oriented. They rejected electoral politics as inherently corrupt and instead embraced direct action, occupations, blockades, anti-nuclear protests, and confrontations with police. To many participants, violence against property and defensive resistance against police were seen not as aggression, but as legitimate self-defense against a violent state. The defining visual and tactical innovation of the Autonomen was the Black Bloc. Beginning in West Berlin and spreading to other cities, groups of demonstrators dressed in black clothing masked their faces and moved as a unified fluid body to prevent individual identification and arrest. The block was both practical and symbolic, signaling anonymity, solidarity, and collective resistance. It was used effectively in clashes over squatter evictions, anti-nuclear demonstrations at Brockdorf and Gorleben, and protests against U.S. missile deployments in Europe during the early 1980s. Throughout the decade, the Ottonomen's confrontations with police became a recurring spectacle. The Battle of Hafenstrasse in Hamburg, when squatters defended their occupied buildings against eviction, epitomized the struggle. Television footage of helmeted police storming barricaded streets made the Ottonomen both notorious and iconic. The German press portrayed them as violent extremists. Sympathizers saw them as the front line of a fight against militarization and capitalist urban policy. By the mid-1980s, the Ottonomen milieu had grown into a subculture, complete with its own aesthetics, black clothing, punk influence, DIY media, and transnational connections. Members traveled to Italy, the Netherlands, and Denmark, exchanging tactics and forming solidarity networks with radical squatters and anti-fascist activists. While numbers remained small, their visibility and influence on protest culture were enormous. Although the Ottonomen declined in the 1990s, as the political landscape shifted and reunification transformed Germany, their legacy endured. The Black Bloc tactic they pioneered became a global export. More broadly, the Ottonomen bequeathed a model of decentralized confrontational activism that continues to shape radical movements worldwide, a legacy of defiance rooted in the streets of Cold War Berlin. Here are two flashpoints illustrate Black Bloc visibility. Seattle, WTO, 1999. What began as broad anti-globalization protests became infamous for hours of property destruction by a self-identified Black Bloc, with openly framed window breaking as strategic against corporate symbols. Seattle's clashes helped make summit protest choreography, mass marches, direct actions, police kettling, and block tactics. Global shorthand. Genoa, G8, 2001. Protests turned deadly when Carlo Giuliani, a 23-year-old demonstrator, was shot and killed during street clashes. The event, and subsequent revelations about police tactics, scarred Italian politics and marked a turning point for summit security worldwide. Later, Hamburg's G20, 2017, again placed Black Bloc imagery at the center of media coverage as police and militants clashed across the city, prompting a massive response and hundreds of arrests. In the U.S., Antifa, as a label, didn't define Seattle 99, but Black Bloc tactics did. Over the 2000s and early 2000s, the tactics surfaced intermittently and then more visibly with Occupy Wall Street, 2011, where organizers debated diversity of tactics, a phrase that, in practice, meant tension between strict nonviolence and a willingness by some to damage property identified with finance or policing. By mid-2000s, U.S. counter-protests against far-right events, Berkeley, Charlottesville era, plus urban uprisings around policing, brought the term Antifa into mainstream American discourse, often as a catch-all shorthand for militant anti-fascist counter-demonstrators using protective gear and block-style tactics. In the wake of George Floyd's murder in May 2020, protests erupted across hundreds of U.S. cities. According to Akeley's data for summer 2020, from late May through August, there were more than 10,600 demonstration events across the country. Though most protests were broad coalitions focused on policing and racial justice, some cities became focal points for more intense clashes and so-called Antifa activity. According to analyses from CSIS and media reporting, Portland, Oregon was by far the principal stage. The protests there ran for months, often nightly, with federal agents deployed to protect U.S. courthouses and other buildings. Clashes, tear gas, and barricades made Portland a media lightning rod. Minneapolis/St. Paul, Minnesota, the city where Floyd was killed, experienced massive unrest, some property destruction, and clashes in the 3rd Precinct area. While not all of that is Antifa per se, it's part of the broader pattern of escalation. Seattle, Washington also saw protest escalation. The Capitol Hill organized protest, CHOP zone, emerged after police withdrew from the East Precinct and confrontations with police and property damage increased. Other cities where local law enforcement or media flagged possible Antifa involvement include Austin, Texas, Spokane, Washington, and Newark, New Jersey. For example, authorities claimed possible Antifa involvement in looting or arson. However, many scholars caution that labeling every act of unrest Antifa overstates the movement's presence. One analysis found that out of nearly 14,000 racial justice protests in 2020, Antifa was identified in just 37, 0.2% of the total. Most of those appearances were in the Pacific Northwest, California, and D.C. In those instances, violence and confrontation rates were statistically higher than average. During and after 2020, many Republican politicians and conservative media amplified narratives that linked Antifa to a broader left-wing conspiracy. Some of the common claims include foreign funding and extremist support. Former Attorney General Bill Barr publicly asserted that Antifa and similar extremist groups were involved in unrest and that foreign actors were playing all sides to escalate violence. Formal designation as terrorists / domestic extremists. Republicans repeatedly pushed for resolutions or designations of Antifa as a domestic terrorist or extremist group. E.g. Senate Resolution 279 in 2019 called for designating Antifa as a domestic terror organization. Some members of Congress's later resolutions echoed similar language. Support from local governments or sanctuary cities. Some Republican voices accused Democratic-led cities of tolerating or even encouraging Antifa and left-wing violence by refusing to crack down, calling them anarchist jurisdictions, or threatening to cut federal funding to them. A common narrative is that Antifa infiltrated or co-opted the Black Lives Matter protests, or that BLM protests were fronts for radical leftism. Critics of that claim point to lack of evidence. For example, many protests were peaceful before any escalation, and many BLM organizers rejected street violence. Republicans and conservative outlets often highlighted damaged property, clashes with police, and isolated violent incidents, attributing them to Antifa or anarchist groups. That framing treated Antifa as a ghost network pulling strings behind many protests. In sum, while Antifa-labeled actors were more visible in hotspots like Portland, Seattle, and Minneapolis, their footprint across the national protest wave was relatively small, according to many studies. The Republican narrative, however, has often amplified or generalized their presence and alleged external support to frame unrest as internally coordinated insurgency rather than spontaneous social mobilization. So what does that leave us with? Historically, Antifa starts as a party-directed anti-fascist front, KPD, in Weimar Germany. Then the tactic set evolves, Black Bloc, via Europe's autonomist movements, and in the U.S., the label becomes shorthand for militant anti-fascist counter-protest. Across decades, one through-line persists: fierce street-level opposition to fascist and far-right actors, and recurring violent conflicts over who controls public space. When we strip away today's headlines, we see Antifa as a historical braid, a Weimar-era brand, a late 20th century tactic, and a 21st century rhetorical battlefield. Understanding that braid lets us judge claims more carefully about who belongs to Antifa, what actions are being described, and which legal tools actually exist. And that brings us to the current issue at hand. Unlike years past, where Antifa and other protesters were mostly ignored or tolerated by the government, the Trump administration has decided to attempt to dismantle the organization and restore order to places like Portland and Chicago. The battle isn't just a confrontation with those in the streets. Trump has decided that cutting off their funding and punishing those who funnel money and supplies to those in the streets is a priority. The question of who funds Antifa and other leftist rioters is a complex and widely debated topic, often clouded by misinformation and political rhetoric. Recent actions by the Trump administration, particularly the designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization in September 2025, have brought increased attention to the funding and support networks behind left-wing protests and riots. Claims have circulated from conservative sources that wealthy individuals and organizations fund Antifa and similar groups, but these claims remain controversial and are often contested. Antifa is not a single unified organization, but rather a loosely connected ideology and collection of autonomous groups united by opposition to fascism and far-right movements. Because it lacks a formal leadership structure or centralized financing, tracing direct funding to Antifa as a whole is inherently difficult. Some conservative commentators and politicians allege that wealthy and influential individuals and groups financially support Antifa and left-wing rioters. A prominent name frequently mentioned in these discussions is George Soros and his Open Society Foundations, which is a progressive philanthropic network. The Department of Justice under the Trump administration was reported to have opened investigations into such organizations to examine alleged funding of leftist activism and violence. However, representatives from Open Society Foundations have categorically denied funding violent protests or Antifa, stating that protests against police brutality are grassroots movements driven by genuine social concerns, not orchestrated or paid for by external financiers. President Trump, in signing an executive order and memorandum, directed federal agencies to investigate and dismantle left-wing extremist networks, including Antifa, and specifically, to trace and disrupt their funding sources. This marked the first all-of-government effort to counter what the administration termed left-wing terrorism. The executive order aims to investigate any material support to these groups and includes agencies such as the FBI, DOJ, Treasury, and IRS. Commentators supporting the government's position describe Antifa and affiliated riot actors as professional anarchists and agitators who receive financial backing from wealthy individuals who prefer to remain anonymous publicly. The professionally made protest signs and organized nature of some demonstrations are cited as evidence of financial support beyond spontaneous grassroots activism. Experts and some news organizations note that Antifa activists come from many left-wing traditions, including anarchism, socialism, and communism, often opposing mainstream liberal parties. Given the decentralized structure, there is skepticism regarding the extent of external funding, with some suggesting that many protests are organic and locally funded by volunteers and smaller leftist organizations. Mainstream media and fact-checkers caution against oversimplifying the issue or accepting conspiracy theories about funding without strong evidence. In conclusion, while the Trump administration has aggressively pursued investigations into Antifa and left-wing riots, including efforts to identify and penalize their funding sources, definitive public evidence tying major wealthy individuals or organizations to sustained funding of Antifa as a monolithic entity remains unconfirmed and contested. The nature of Antifa as a decentralized movement complicates financial tracing, and numerous claims about funding require careful scrutiny due to the politically charged environment around this issue. One thing is clear: as the ICE raids continue, and it appears that confrontations will be increasing in the months ahead, the violence in the streets between protesters and law enforcement is not going to abate anytime soon. That concludes this week's episode. Please like and subscribe to the podcast, and if there is a topic you would like to see featured on the Roots of Today podcast, please leave a comment. Finally, remember to get informed and keep your elected representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.